This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents An Absolutely Remarkable Thing by Hank Green. Read for you by Kristen C. with Hank Green. Thanks, Mom! Chapter 1. Look, I am aware that you're here for an epic tale of intrigue and mystery and adventure and near death and actual death. But in order to get to that, unless you want to skip to chapter 13, I'm not your boss, you're going to have to deal with the fact that I, April May, in addition to being one of the most important things that has ever happened to the human race, am also a woman in her 20s who has made some mistakes. I am in the wonderful position of having you by the short hairs. I have the story, and so I get to tell it to you the way I want. That means you get to understand me, not just my story. So don't be surprised if there's some drama. I'm going to attempt to come at this account honestly, but I'll also admit to a significant pro-me bias. If you get anything out of this, ideally it won't be you being more or less on one side or the other, but simply understanding that I am, or at least was, human. And I was very much feeling only human as I dragged my tired ass down 23rd Street at 2:45 a.m. after working a 16-hour day at a startup that, thanks to an aggressively shitty contract I signed, will remain nameless. Going to art school might seem like a terrible financial decision, but really, that's only true if you have to take out gobs and gobs of student loans to fund your hoity-toity education. Of course, I had done exactly that. My parents were successful, running a business providing equipment to small and medium-sized dairy farms. Like the little things you hook up to cows to get the milk out. They sold and distributed them. It was good business. Good enough that I wouldn't have had a lot of debt if I'd gone to a state school. But I did not do that. I had loans. Lots. So after jumping from major to major, advertising, fine art, photography, illustration, and finally settling on the mundane but at least useful BFA in design, I took the first job that would keep me in New York and out of my old bedroom in my parents' house in Northern California. And that was a job at a doomed startup funded by the endless well of rich people who can only dream the most boring dream a rich person can dream, being even more rich. Of course, working at a startup means that you're part of the family, and so when things go wrong, or when deadlines fly past, or when an investor has a hissy fit, or just because, you don't get out of work until 3 in the morning. Which, honestly, I hated. I hated it because the company's time management app was a dumb idea and didn't actually help people. I hated it because I knew I was just doing it for the money. And I hated it because they asked the staff to treat it like their whole life rather than like a day job, which meant I didn't have any time to spare to work on personal projects. But I was actually using my degree doing actual graphic design and getting paid enough to afford rent less than 1 year out of school. My work environment was close to technically criminal, and I paid half of my income to sleep in the living room of a one-bedroom apartment, but I was making it work. I fibbed just now. My bed was in the living room, but I mostly slept in the bedroom. Maya's room. We weren't living together. We were roommates. And April from the past would want me to be very clear about that. What's the difference between those two things? Well, mostly that we weren't dating before we moved in together. Hooking up with your roommate is convenient, but it is also a little confusing when you live together through much of college, before finally hooking up, and have now been a couple for more than a year. If you happen to already live together, when does the "should we move in together" question come up? Well, for Maya and me, the question was, can we please move that secondhand mattress out of the living room so that we can sit on a couch when we watch Netflix? And thus far, my answer had been, absolutely not, we are just roommates who are dating. Which is why our living room still had a bed in it. I told you there would be drama. Anyway, back to the middle of the night that fateful January evening. This shitty app had to get a new release into the App Store by next week, and I had been waiting for the final approvals on some user interface changes and whatever. You don't care. It was boring work BS. Instead of coming in early, I stayed late, which has always been my preference. My brain was sucked entirely dry from trying to interpret cryptic guidance from bosses who couldn't tell a raster from a vector. I checked out of the building. It was a co-working space, not even actual leased offices, and walked the 3 minutes to the subway station. And then my Metro card got rejected, for no reason. I had another one sitting on my desk at work, and I wasn't precisely sure how much money I had in my checking account, so it seemed like I should walk the 3 blocks back to the office just to be safe. The walk sign is on, so I cross 23rd, and a taxi cab blares its horn like I shouldn't be in the crosswalk. Whatever, dude, I have the walk light. I turn to head back to the office, and immediately, I see it. As I approach, it becomes clear that it is a really, really exceptional sculpture. I mean, it's awesome, but it's also a little bit New York awesome, you know? How do I explain how I felt about it? I guess, well, in New York City, people spend 10 years making something amazing happen. Something that captures the essence of an idea so perfectly that suddenly the world becomes 10 times clearer. It's beautiful and it's powerful, and someone devoted a huge piece of their life to it. The local news does a story about it and everyone goes, neat. And then tomorrow we forget about it in favor of some other absolutely perfect and remarkable thing. That doesn't make those things unwonderful or not unique. It's just that there are a lot of people doing a lot of amazing things, so eventually you get a little jaded. So that's how I felt when I saw it. A 10-foot-tall transformer, wearing a suit of samurai armor, its huge barrel chest lifted up to the sky a good 4 or 5 feet above my head. It just stood there, in the middle of the sidewalk, full of energy and power. It looked like it might, at any moment, turn and fix that empty, regal stare on me. But instead, it just stood there, silent and almost scornful, like the world didn't deserve its attention. In the streetlight, the metal was a patchwork of black-as-night matte and mirror-reflective silver. And it clearly was metal, not some spray-painted cardboard cosplay thing. It was stunningly done. I paused for maybe 5 seconds before shivering both in the cold and in the gaze of the thing, and then walking on. And then I felt like the biggest jerk. I mean, I'm an artist working way too hard at a deeply uninteresting job to pay way too much in rent so I can stay in this place, so that I can remain immersed in one of the most creative and influential cultures on Earth. Here in the middle of the sidewalk is a piece of art that was a massive undertaking, an installation that the artist worked on possibly for years to make people stop and look and consider. And here I am, hardened by big city life and mentally drained by hours of pixel pushing, not even giving something so magnificent a second glance. I remember this moment pretty clearly, so I guess I'll mention it. I went back to the sculpture, got up on my tiptoes, and I said, "Do you think I should call Andy?" The sculpture, of course, did nothing. "Just stand there if it's okay for me to call Andy." And so I made the call. But first, some background on Andy. You know those moments when your life shifts and you think, I will definitely, without a doubt, continue to love and appreciate and connect with all of these cool people I have spent so many years with, despite the fact that our lives are changing a great deal right now? And then instead, you might as well unfriend them on Facebook because you ain't never gonna see that dude again in your whole life. Well, Andy, Maya, and I had somehow, thus far, managed to avoid that fate. Maya and I had done it by occupying the same 400 square feet. Andy, on the other hand, lived across town from us, and we didn't even know him until junior year. Maya and I, by that point, were taking most of the same classes because, well, we really liked each other a lot. We were obviously going to be in the same group whenever there was a group project. But Professor Kennedy was dividing us up into groups of three, which meant a random third wheel. Somehow we got stuck with Andy. Or probably from his perspective, he got stuck with us. I knew who Andy was. I had formed a vague impression of him that was mostly, that guy sure is more confident than he has any right to be. He was skinny and awkward with printer paper pale skin. I assume he began his haircuts by asking the stylist to make it look like he had never received a haircut. But he was always primed for some quip, and for the most part, those quips were either funny or insightful. The project was a full brand treatment for a fictional product. Packaging was optional, but we needed several logo options and a style guide, which is like a little book that tells everyone how the brand should be presented and what fonts and colors are to be used in what situations. It was more or less a given that we would be doing this for some hip and groovy fictional company that makes ethical fair trade jeans with completely useless pockets or something. Actually, it was almost always a fictional brewery because we're college students. We're paying a lot of money to cultivate our taste in beer and be snobby about it. And I'm sure that's the direction Maya and I would have gone in, But Andy was intolerably stubborn and somehow convinced us both that we would be building the visual identity of Bubble Bum, a butt-flavored bubble gum. At first, his arguments were silly, that we weren't going to be doing fancy cool shit when we graduated, so we might as well not take the project so seriously. But he convinced us when he got serious. "Look, guys," he said, "it's easy to make something cool look cool. That's why everyone picks cool things. Ultimately, though, cool is always going to be boring. What if we can make something dumb look amazing? Something unmarketable, awesome. That's a real challenge. That takes real skill. Let's show real skill." I remember this pretty clearly because it was when I realized there was more to Andy. By the end of the project, I couldn't help feeling a little superior to the rest of our classmates, taking their skinny jeans and craft breweries so seriously, and the final product did look great. Andy was, and I had known this but not really filed it as important, an extremely talented illustrator, and with Maya's hand lettering skills and my color palette work, it did end up looking pretty great. So that's how Maya and I met Andy. And thank God we did. Frankly, we needed a third wheel to even out the intensity of the early part of our relationship. After the Bubble Bum project, which Kennedy loved so much he put it on the class website, we became a bit of a trio. We even worked on some freelance projects together. And occasionally Andy would come over to our apartment and force us to play board games. And then we'd just spend the evening talking about politics or dreams or anxieties. The fact that he was obviously a little bit in love with me never really bothered any of us because he knew I was taken, and, well, I don't think Maya saw him as a threat. Somehow our dynamic hadn't fractured after graduation, and we kept hanging out with funny, weird, smart, stupid Andy Scamped, who I was now calling at 3 o'clock in the morning.
"The fuck, April? It's 3 a.m.
"Hey, I've got something you might want to see."
"It seems likely that this can wait until tomorrow."
"No, this is pretty cool. Bring your camera. And does Jason have any lights?" Jason was Andy's roommate. Both of them wanted to be internet famous. They would stream themselves playing video games to tiny audiences, and they had a podcast about the best TV death scenes that they also filmed and uploaded to YouTube. To me, it just seemed like that incurable ailment so many well-off dudes have, believing, despite mountains of evidence, that what the world truly needs is another white guy comedy podcast. This sounds harsh, but that's what it seemed like to me back then. Now, of course, I know how easy it is to feel like you don't matter if no one's watching. I've also since listened to Slain Spotting, and it's actually pretty funny.
"Wait, what's happening? What am I doing?" he asked.
"Here's what you're doing. You're walking over to Gramercy Theater and you're going to bring as much of Jason's video shit as you can, and you're not going to regret it, so don't even think about going back to whatever hentai VR game you're playing. This is better, I promise."
"You say that, but have you played Cherry Blossom Fairy 5, April May? Have you?"
"I'm hanging up. You're going to be here in 5 minutes." I hung up. Several people who weren't Andy walked by as I waited for him. Manhattan is less legit than it once was, for sure, but this is still the city that never sleeps. It is also the city of, "Behold the field in which I grow my fucks. Lay thine eyes upon it and see that it is barren." People gave the sculpture a quick glance and kept on walking, just as I had very nearly done. I tried to look busy. Manhattan's a safe place, but that doesn't mean a 23-year-old woman by herself on the street at 3 a.m. isn't going to get randomly harassed. For the next few minutes, I got to spend a little time with the structure. Manhattan is never really dark. There was lots of light around, but the deep shadows and the sculpture's size made it difficult to really understand it. It was massive. It probably weighed several hundred pounds. I took my glove off and poked it, finding the metal surprisingly not cool. Not warm either, exactly, but hard. I gave it a knock on the pelvis and didn't hear the bell ring I expected. It was more of a thunk, followed by a low hum. I started to think that this was part of the artist's intentions, that the goal was for the people of New York to interact with this object, to discover its properties. When you're in art school, you do a lot of thinking about objectives and intent. That was just the default state. See art, critique art. Eventually, I stopped my critique and just took it in. I was starting to really love it. not just as a creation of someone else, but the way that you love really good art. Just enjoying it. It was so unlike other things I'd seen. And brave in its transformerness. Like, I would be terrified to do anything that visually reflected mecha robots in any way. No one wants to be compared to something that's mainstream popular. That's the worst of all possible fates. But there was much more to this piece than that. It seemed to have come from a completely different place than any work I'd ever seen before, sculptural or not. I was pretty caught up in the thing when Andy snapped me out of it. What the absolute fuck? He was wearing a backpack and three camera straps and holding two tripods. Yup, I replied. That is awesome. I know. The awful thing is, I almost walked right by it. I just thought, well, there's another fucking cool New York City thing. I kept on walking. But it occurred to me that I hadn't heard or seen anything about it, and since, you know, you're always in search of your big viral hit, you might want to get the scoop. So I've been guarding it for you. So you saw this big, beautiful, muscular piece of art, and who sprung into your mind but Andy Scamped? His thumbs were digging into his bony chest. LOL, I said sarcastically. In fact, I figured I'd do you a favor, and here it is. So maybe just appreciate it. A little dejected, he handed me a tripod. Well, let's start getting the shit set up then. Gotta work before Channel 6 drunkenly stumbles by and steals our scoop. In 5 minutes, the camera was set up, a battery-powered light was glaring, and Andy was clamping the mic to his lapel. He didn't look as dopey as he had in school. He'd stopped wearing stupid ball caps, and he'd given up on his unruly or just uncommon haircuts in favor of a short, wavy thing that complemented his face shape. But despite the fact that he was 8 inches taller than me and almost exactly my age, he still looked about 5 years my junior. April, he said. Yeah? I think maybe it should be you. I probably replied with some kind of confused grunt. In front of the camera, I mean. Dude, this is your dream, not mine. I don't know shit about YouTube. It's just, I mean, well, looking back, I think it's possible, though I've never asked him, that he had some idea that this would actually be a big deal. Not as big a deal as it would turn out to be, of course, but big. Hey, don't think you're going to win my favor by giving me internet fame. I don't even want that. Right, but you have no idea how to use this camera. I could tell he was making an excuse, but I couldn't figure out why. I don't know how to do behind-the-camera stuff, but I also don't know how to do in-front-of-the-camera stuff. You and Jason talk to the internet all day long. I barely have a Facebook. You have an Instagram? That's different, I smirked. Not really. I can tell you care about what you post on there. You're not fooling anyone. You're a digital girl, April, in a digital world. We all know how to perform. God bless Andy for being blunt. He was right, of course. I tried not to care about social media, and I really did prefer hanging out in art galleries to hanging out on Twitter. But I wasn't as disconnected as I made myself out to be. Being annoyed by carefully crafted internet personas was part of my carefully crafted internet persona. Even so, I think we could both feel Andy stretching for a point that wasn't 100% there. Andy, what is this actually about? It's just... He took a deep breath. I think it would be better for the artist if it were you. I'm a fucking goof. I know what I look like. People aren't going to take me seriously. You look like an artist with your pea coat and your cheekbones. You look like you know what you're talking about. You do know what you're talking about. And you talk it good, girl. If I do this, I'm gonna make it a joke. Plus, you're the one who found it. I think it just makes more sense for you to be in front of the camera. Unlike most of my classmates who graduated with design degrees, I thought a lot about fine art. If you're wondering what the difference is, well, fine art is like art that exists for its own sake. The thing that fine art does is itself. Design is art that does something else. It's more like visual engineering. I started school focusing on fine art, but I decided by the end of the first semester that maybe I wanted to someday have a job. So I switched to advertising, which I hated. So I switched a bunch more times until I caved, and went into design. But I still spent way more time and energy paying attention to the fine art scene in Manhattan than any of my design track friends did. It was part of why I desperately wanted to stay in the city. This may sound dumb, but just being a 20-something in New York City made me feel important. Even if I wasn't doing real art, at least I was making it work in this city, a long ways away from my parents' literal dairy supply business. Ultimately, Andy wasn't showing any signs of giving up, and I determined that this wasn't actually that big of a deal. So I ran the mic up the inside of my shirt. The cord was warm from Andy's body. The light shined in my eyes, and I could barely see the lens. It was cold. There was a little breeze. We were alone on the sidewalk. "Are you ready?" he said. "Give me that mic," I said, pointing at an open bag on the ground. "Your lav is speeding. You don't need it." I had no idea what that meant, but I got the gist. "No, just as a prop so I can interview it." "Ah, cool." He handed me the mic. "Okay," I said. "Okay, I'm rolling." Chapter 2. "Okay, I'm rolling." You've heard Andy say those words. If you're a human who's ever been near enough to an internet connection to hear them, whether or not you speak English, whether or not you've ever owned an electronic device in your life, if you're a Chinese billionaire or a Kiwi sheep farmer, you've heard it. Militant rebels in Nepal have heard it. It's the most viewed piece of media of all time. It's been viewed more times than there are humans on Earth. Google estimates that New York Carl has been watched by 94% of living humans. And by this point, I suppose, a fair number of dead ones. After Andy edited the video, this is roughly what we had. I'm a mess. I've been awake for 22 hours. I'm barely wearing makeup, and the dress code at work was basically whatever looks like you care the least, so I'm wearing a denim jacket over a white hoodie, and my jeans have holes in the knees, which isn't helping me keep warm. My black hair is loose around my shoulders. The light is glaring in my eyes, and I'm fighting to keep from squinting. But considering all that, I don't look so bad. Maybe I've just watched the video enough times that I'm over the embarrassment. My eyes are dark enough that they look all pupil, even when the sun is out. My teeth are shining in Jason's LED light. Somehow I seem chipper. The giddiness of lack of sleep has taken over. My voice is croaky. "Hello, I'm April May, and I'm here at 23rd and Lexington with an unannounced and peculiar visitor. He arrived sometime before 3 a.m. today, guarding the Chipotle Mexican Grill next door to the Gramercy Theater like an ancient warrior of an unknown civilization. His icy stare is somehow comforting. It's like, look, none of us has our lives figured out. Not even this 10-foot-tall metal warrior. The weight of life getting you down? Don't worry, you're insignificant. Do I feel safer with him watching over me? I do not. But maybe safety isn't what it's all about." A couple headed home after a long night walk by while I say this, looking over their shoulders more at the camera than at the giant freaking robot. The camera angle changes abruptly. This was after a few seconds of me mumbling around for something to say and sounding like an idiot, and Andy assuring me that he'd edit out the parts where I sounded like an idiot. "His name is Carl. Hello, Carl." Here I hold the dummy mic to Carl, standing on my tiptoes. I'm a small person, 5'2". This makes Carl look even bigger than he is. Carl says nothing. "A robot of few words, but your appearance speaks volumes." Another cut. Now I'm staring back at the camera. Carl, immovable, solid, and somehow warm to the touch. A 10-foot-tall robot that New Yorkers appear to think is not particularly interesting. Cut. What do they think he is? An art installation? A pet project evicted from his apartment along with a deadbeat tenant? A forgotten prop from a nearby film shoot? Has the city that never sleeps become the city that's too cool to notice even the most peculiar and astounding occurrences? No, wait. One young man has stopped to see. Let's ask him what he thinks. Cut. Now Andy shares the fake mic with me. "And you are?" Andy scamped. Somehow Andy is more nervous than me. "And you can confirm that there is a 10-foot-tall robot standing outside of Chipotle?" "I can." "And can you confirm that this is in fact not fucking normal?" "Uh-huh." "What do you think it means?"
I don't know, actually. Now that I'm thinking about it, Carl kind of terrifies me. Thank you, Andy. Cut. And there you have it, citizens of the world. A giant, stately, terrifying, slightly warm robot man has arrived in New York City and, through his inaction, has somehow become only interesting enough for a one-minute-long video. All of this is said over close shots of the robot, his immobility teeming with movement, energy glistening just below the surface. The whole time I was in front of the camera, I was thinking of the artist, a fellow creator who had poured her soul into something truly remarkable that might simply be ignored by the whole world. I was trying to get in her head. I was trying to figure out why she had created this thing, and, in the same breath, calling out the world for its callous ignorance of beauty and form. Calling all New Yorkers, appreciate how cool shit can be. I wanted people to wake up and spend a few moments looking at the exceptional amazement of human creation. Hilarious, in hindsight. Is that good? Yeah, great. Fantastic. You're adorable and smart, and the internet is going to love you. Oh, just what I've always wanted, I deadpanned. I am suddenly extremely tired. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Why are you even awake right now? Aside from the giant robot? You know, another day, another all-hands-on-deck crisis. At least you have a job. Andy was trying his hand at freelance, which is what you do when you don't have to worry about paying student loans because your dad is a filthy rich Hollywood lawyer. And just like that, Carl was out of the conversation. Andy grabbed a few close-up shots while I whined about work, and he told me about a new client who wanted their logo to look more computery. I even got on Andy's shoulders to get as close to the robot's face as I could, trying to hold the camera steady for B-roll. But we were just talking about work and life, and then it was almost 4 a.m. Well, this has been super fucking weird, April May. Thank you for calling me out into the chill of the night to make a robot video with you. And thank you for coming. And no, I'm not coming over to watch you edit a video. I'm going to bed. If you call me before noon, I'm going to impale you on that spiky thing Carl's got on his head. Always a pleasure. See you tomorrow. On the subway ride home, I set my phone to do not disturb mode. That night was probably the best night's sleep I had until after I died. Chapter 3. I woke up at 2 p.m. I hadn't even woken up when Maya got out of bed. She came into the room doing that knock softly while you open the door thing, which was somehow both annoying and endearing. She was carrying a cup of coffee. The room was, for my tastes, pleasantly cluttered. A couple of items of clothes on the floor, one too many cups on the desk, way too many books on the nightstands. I don't really understand people who keep everything around them constantly neat. It's way more efficient to do occasional dedicated cleanups than constant maintenance. Plus, my mind likes clutter. It's almost like I need to make the world around me messy to make my art and ideas neat. Simplicity in design, complete disaster in everything else. It was an entire ethos I was working on. Of course, Maya kept me from going completely off the rails. Maya was far more personally put together than I was. But neither of us were neat freaks, which helped make the roommate thing work. She had clearly been up for hours. Her locks were in some fancy updo that remained mostly magical to me. That meant she was probably doing something important later. She'd probably told me about it, but I couldn't remember what it was if she had. Meeting a client for work, maybe? She was the only one of us who had gotten work at a real design firm. It didn't pay great, but it was a foot in the door. Her makeup was already done. In addition to being a better apartment steward than I, she was also a much better relationship steward. All the weirdness in the relationship stemmed from me. I actively stopped her from talking about serious stuff. If it weren't for my issues, we would have moved in together a long time ago. I brought you a cup of coffee, she said softly, in case I wasn't already awake. And after years of living together, you haven't noticed that I never drink coffee? This is not true. She put the coffee on my nightstand. You only drink coffee on very, very bad days. She sat down on the side of the bed. I turned to her with a big old question mark on my face. April, this robot thing has gotten a little weird. You know about Carl? Why did you give him that stupid name? She asked, exasperated.
You know about Carl. It wasn't a question anymore. I know about Carl. Has Andy been bugging you? I cut in before she could continue, annoyed that he couldn't leave it until morning, or rather late afternoon. Don't interrupt. I let you sleep, she demanded. Andy has been calling all day and he's freaking out and he needs you to check your email. In there, you'll find a number of important things to read, including several messages from local news stations and entertainment agents and managers. I don't think this is the kind of thing you want to ignore, but I also don't think it's something to rush. Maya was the most effective talker I knew. It was like she wrote essays in her brain and then recited them verbatim. She once explained to me that she thought this was part of being black in America. Every black person who spends time with a lot of white people eventually ends up being asked to speak for every black person, she told me one night after it was too late to still be talking. And I hate that. It's really stupid. And everyone gets to respond to that idiocy however they want. But my anxiety eventually made me extremely careful about everything I said. Because, of course, I don't represent capital B black people. But if people think I do, then I still feel a responsibility to try to do it well. I never had any idea what to say when she talked about this stuff. I'm white, and I was raised in a very white community. So I just said the thing that I'd heard you should say in situations like this. That sounds really hard. Yeah, she replied. Everybody has their hard parts. Thanks. God, I hope you don't feel like you have to represent all black people with me, I said. I hope you're not, like, careful all the time. No, April. And then it was a long time before she continued. I'm careful with you for different reasons. I was too afraid to ask what that meant, so I kissed her, and then we went to sleep. In any case, Maya's efficiency of speech was extremely helpful in the maintenance of a relationship that I was subconsciously keeping on the knife edge between casual and serious. She was capable of talking with her eyes and her body, but she mostly chose to use her mouth. I didn't mind this. Maya is as far as I got before she put her index finger softly on my lips. I said through her finger, Are we gonna make out now? No, you're going to drink your coffee and check your email and not talk again to me or anyone else until you've brushed your teeth. Because your mouth smells like trillions of microorganisms. I have taken away your phone. You can have it back when you're done with your email. She stood up off the bed without so much as a kiss. But I... She drowned me out as she walked to the doorway. Stop talking. Read. She closed the door. 10 minutes later, I was freshened up a little bit, sitting on the bed with my laptop. Read messages were blue, unread messages were white. Important and unread was white for 5 pages. I had no idea what to do, so I just searched for andyscamped@gmail.com, and that cleared things up pretty quickly. One of the 15 messages he had sent me was titled, Read this one first, and another was titled, Read this one second. And a third more recent email was titled, No, this one, read this one first. Here they are, copied and pasted straight out of my inbox. No, this one, read this one first. I'm sorry, all of the emails I have sent today sound as if they were written in a demented frenzy. I value our friendship. Let's try and keep that front of mind. Andy. Read this one first. Okay, so, whoa. I'm going to give you a quick rundown of everything that has happened in the last 6 hours. This is everything that isn't conjecture. Carl didn't just show up in New York. There's one in pretty much every city on Earth. There are at least 60 Carls. Photos of Carls are popping up everywhere from Beijing to Buenos Aires. People just stumbled across them, like we did. And people around the world have posted photos and videos on social media, yet somehow ours is the one that's taken off. It has to be some kind of international street art project, and we, basically got the scoop. All of them went up without anyone seeing the installers, and no one can find any surveillance footage. I'm sure they will eventually, but they don't have anything yet. Everyone is calling them Carls because they didn't have anything else to call them. It's not like there's an artist statement on foam core glued to the sidewalk next to them.
They're playing our video on the news without permission, I'll add. Several news outlets have contacted me to talk about it. The video has already had more than 1 million views. People love you. Don't read the comments. I've already been back to Carl with a nicer camera to take some daytime footage. I got there before the crowds did, but it's wild out there now. He's a freaking tourist attraction. I haven't slept since you called me. I feel like a small dog is eating my eyeballs from the inside. Andy. Read this second. Hey, so did you know that my dad is a lawyer? This is weird, but like, our video has gotten 1 million views already and it's actually made some money and we need to figure out how to split it. However, since I don't think there's any way to figure out exactly who contributed what to this video, and it's safe to say that neither of us would have made it if it weren't for the other, I am proposing a 50-50 split on the ownership of the video. I would also like to propose a 50-50 split on the ownership of my YouTube channel, Scamper2001, which I named when I was 11 and am going to regret for literally the rest of my life. Final proposal. We should collaborate on future videos about Carl's, but we can talk about that later. I had my dad draw up a contract that says that we each own 50% of the video and are entitled to 50% of the revenue from it. It basically also means that I can't do anything with the content without your approval, and you can't do anything without my approval. I know this is dumb, but he's a lawyer, and this is what they do. He would also like for me to propose to you that he represent you as your lawyer when we sue all of the major networks for using our video without permission. I told him to cool his jets, so his jets are currently on ice. Just so you know, the video has thus far earned about $2,000, so basically we're rich. Andy. A quick read through the rest of my inbox made me kinda wish I hadn't listed my email on my portfolio website. There indeed were a bunch from entertainment managers and agents. Some people wanted me to know how much they liked my video. Some wanted me to know that if I was going to be in a YouTube video, there were a number of things I could have done to improve my physical appearance. And really, why hadn't I done that? There was one that was very clearly creepier than the rest of the normal creepiness. It is amazing how disconcerting a single, vile, manipulative person can be, even if you have never, and hopefully will never, see them. The power that each of us has over complete strangers to make them feel terrible and frightened and weak is amazing. This was not the first time someone had made me feel this way, but it was the first time it had happened through the internet, and it was enough to make me want to withdraw from the whole thing for a moment. Just a moment, though. There was a message from my dad, really both my parents. They did this adorable tag team email thing. I swear they sat next to each other on the couch and wrote emails like it was a three-way call. They should make special tablets with two keyboards just for them. It was sent like a long text message about how they thought the video was great and I sure looked tired and they couldn't wait to see me at Tom's wedding and was I getting enough sleep? The only message that is long-term important in the story was one titled, "You said it was warm? I'll just copy it directly for you." "You said it was warm? Ms. May, my name is Miranda Beckwith. I'm a graduate student in materials science at UC Berkeley. I watched your video this morning and found it both entertaining and fascinating. I was particularly interested when you referred to Carl as slightly warm. Of course, I'm sure your life is ridiculous right now, but knowing a bit about materials and having seen Carl, it's unusual for something that seems so heavy and shiny to not have a low thermal conductivity. Basically, Carl looks like he's made of a metal. But it's January in New York, so my guess is it's quite cold, and metal at ambient temperature would have felt very cold. Initial reports are that these things are super heavy, so it doesn't make sense that they would be made out of coated plastic. I have no idea what else would not feel very cold to the touch, but also be heavy and shiny. Unless he actually felt warm, in which case there is likely some kind of power source inside of him keeping him warm. There's a Carl here in the Bay Area, but it's looking less and less likely that I'll be getting my hands on him, so I was just wondering if you could satisfy my curiosity. Was Carl warm like touching styrofoam would be warm? Or was he warm like touching a mug full of coffee would be warm? Did you notice anything else about him that would help with this mystery? Thank you for your time, and I totally understand if you're not able to get back to me. Miranda. That was the only email I responded to that day. Re, you said it was warm. Miranda.
Thanks for your message. On the list of peculiar things about Carl, this didn't really stand out, but now that you mention it, it was super weird. He didn't feel warm, he just didn't feel like a temperature. I wouldn't have been able to articulate it without the prompt, but it was very much like hard, smooth styrofoam. Like he didn't have heat, but all of my hand heat stayed in my hand when I touched him. I did actually give him a good whack with my knuckles, and it was like a thunk, followed by a faint, low hum. It didn't give at all. It was like knocking on a painted brick wall. I imagine I'll have a pretty hard time getting up close with New York Carl again, too, so I probably won't be able to be of much further help. Sounds like whoever did this is going above and beyond in the weirdness category. April. With that, I considered myself done enough. Maya, phone please. This is super weird, right? She shouted back unseen before coming into her room. So what's the damage? I asked, gesturing to the phone. You are suddenly extremely popular. Andy would like to talk. He would like to talk a lot. He would like to talk for at least 4 years. Your parents also called. I called my parents. They were fine, if a little stressed. My slightly older, very successful, extremely normal brother Tom was getting married in Northern California in a few months, and they were helping with a lot of the planning. Tom had studied math and worked at an investment bank in San Francisco. I kept expecting him to move to New York with all the other investment bankers, but he wasn't doing it. I want to be very clear that whatever hang-ups I have are 100% mine. I had a very happy childhood. I just wasn't a very happy child. My parents have always been supportive and without expectations, which is pretty much all a kid can ask for. So we talked about Carl and about Tom and about how much they loved Tom's fiance and how smooth the planning was going, even if it was still a lot of work. They wanted to know what I knew about Carl, so I told them a bunch of stuff they mostly already knew. They asked about work and hinted that they could give me some money if I needed it, which they always did and I always ignored. They loved the video and they were proud of me. For what? Who knows? Parents, right? I called Andy, who sounded unstable. April May, this is getting really weird. I winced away from the phone. You're going to need to be calm with me right now. The video has had 3 million views now. People think you're fantastic. You aren't reading the comments, right? I haven't actually watched the video yet. You're like the only person who has not seen it. The story just keeps getting weirder. They still haven't found any surveillance footage. There's a camera that shows the spot pretty clearly, but at 2:43 a.m., it just cuts out, records nothing for 5 minutes, and when it comes back, Carl is just standing there. Military analysts say it's possible that an EMP knocked out all the local electricity for every Carl while they were being installed, and they were all installed at the exact same time. The thing that makes this weirder is that the static that the security cameras recorded wasn't random. The cameras that were recording audio, everyone that the news has gotten their hands on has an undertone of static that is very clearly, if you turn it up loud enough, "Don't Stop Me Now" by Queen. I love that song.
Really?
Yeah, why?
No, I just never even heard of it. But yeah, if you listen, it's there. No one knows how it could have gotten there. Some extremely high-energy radio pulse, maybe?
Yeah, this is super weird, but Andy, it doesn't really have much to do with us, does it? I mean, we made the video. I'm happy to say that we spotted the New York Carl.
Just New York Carl, he interrupted.
What?
New York Carl. That's the one in New York's name, not the New York Carl. Everyone is calling it New York Carl, and the one in Mumbai is Mumbai Carl, and there's Hong Kong Carl and Sao Paulo Carl. Even people who don't speak English are calling their Carls Carl.
You being picky about nomenclature is not changing my point. We didn't make Carl, we just found him. Not even. We found, like, 1/60th of him.
I made this point to my dad. He babbled for, like, 10 minutes about narrative and mimetic diffusion and cultural mythology, and he totally convinced me with an argument that I am completely incapable of repeating. Which brings me to the most salient point. I just made $10,000.
There was a long pause, and then I finally said, neat?
News stations would very much like to interview you, but they took me instead because I'm the best they could do at the moment. Pundits and experts are blabbing about Carl for about 5 minutes every hour, but there's only so much they can say to keep it interesting. They can't interview Carl, but they can interview you. My dad says he can get us a $10,000 licensing deal with all the major networks if you agree to do interviews. Wait, total or per network? Per network. They're totally fucked because they already ran the footage. Dad has them by the balls. My head wasn't working super fast, but I did recognize that $10,000 multiplied by the number of news networks I could think of would eliminate a sizable portion of my student loans. I could quit my shit job. I could have time in the evenings to do things that were my idea. I would have to go on TV. You would get to go on TV. What am I supposed to say on TV? You just answer their questions. Do I have to do my hair? April, May, it's gonna be like $50,000. Okay, fine. I'm in. Within the next 30 minutes, I had two network news interviews scheduled for that day. And figuring that I should probably have something worth saying, Maya and I spent the hours I had free before I had to head downtown reading everything that we could about Carl. It wasn't much. Andy had caught me up pretty thoroughly. I was a little bit terrified about going on the news and honestly had no idea what I was supposed to say. I saw this thing. It was cool. I don't know what it is. My friend and I made a video. That's like 19 seconds. Doesn't seem worth precisely $10,000, but I didn't know how TV worked. Turns out they mostly just wanted to keep using the footage that they'd already stolen from us without getting sued. I ended up on the Wikipedia page for Don't Stop Me Now, the barely audible song that bizarrely showed up on all the static-filled security camera footage of areas where Carl's had appeared. Don't Stop Me Now is a song by the British rock band Queen, featured on their 1978 album Jazz that was released as a single in 1979. Written by lead singer Freddie Mercury, it was recorded in August 1978 at Super Bear Studios in Bar-les-Alpes, Alpes-Maritimes, France, and is the 12th track on the album. Weird, I thought. Typos like written don't usually make it into Wikipedia. But being the good steward of the internet that I was, I edited the page, fixing the typo, then went back and reloaded the page. Don't Stop Me Now is a song by the British rock band Queen, featured on their 1978 album Jazz that was released as a single in 1979. Written by lead singer Freddie Mercury, it was recorded in August 1978 at Super Bear Studios in Bar-les-Alpes, Alpes-Maritimes, France, and is the 12th track on the album. Hey, Maya? Can you bring up the Wikipedia page for Don't Stop Me Now? Yeah? Do you see any typos? Two in the first paragraph. Two? Yeah, released and written are both spelled wrong. Fix them. Yes, master. Just do it. Something is weird. She fixed them, and we both reloaded the page. Don't Stop Me Now is a song by the British rock band Queen, featured in their 1978 album Jazz that was released as a single in 1979. Written by lead singer Freddie Mercury, it was recorded in August 1978 at Super Bear Studios in Bar-les-Alpes, Alpes-Maritimes, France, and is the 12th track on the album. Okay, Maya said. There is no conceivable way that I didn't see that someone misspelled the word album after you specifically asked me to look for typos. I'm fucking fastidious. She was. I'm going to fix it again, I said. I fixed all the typos and reloaded the page again. Don't Stop Me Now is a song by the British rock band Queen, featured on their 1978 album Jazz that was released as a single in 1979. Written by lead singer Freddie Mercury, it was recorded in August 1978 at Super Bear Studios in Bar-les-Alpes, Alpes-Maritimes, France, and is the 12th track on the album. The U in August is gone now, I said, getting more freaked out. I called Andy. Yellow, he said, still clearly delirious. Can you go to the Wikipedia page for Don't Stop Me Now right now? I said without any preamble. Yup. I could hear him rustling around for his computer. I just waited. Okay, loading up, and... I heard the keys clacking. Do you see any typos in the first paragraph? Yes, there's no I in written. And that's all. Is this a test? What about released or album or August? I have had a very weird day, April, but you are making it considerably weirder. Answer the question. No, all those words are spelled correctly. You do know how Wikipedia works, right? You can change the page. Somebody probably just fixed it. I reloaded the page again. All the same typos, no new ones. Fix the typo. April. We're supposed to be downtown to shoot for ABC News in like 2 hours. There are a lot of errors on Wikipedia and we aren't going to fix them all today. Oh my God, Andy, do the thing! I loudly monotoned. I already did. I did it while I was whining. It is not fixed. Oh. Actually, this is weird. Released is now misspelled. Wait, that was one of the words you listed. How did you do that? Maya chimed in. Put him on speaker. So I did. Andy, this is Maya. The same thing happened to us, but it didn't require me to make the first change before I saw the second one. Probably because April and I are on the same IP address. Every time I fix a typo, I see a new one, as well as the one I just fixed. According to the Wikipedia log pages, no one is making these changes. Indeed, according to the Wikipedia log, no one has made any changes, including us, to this page since 3 hours ago when an editor added a note about the song playing in security camera footage. In the time that you two were talking, I tried to fix the final letter and I didn't see any more typos. It seems as if we have run into a dead end. Additionally, we are not going to figure this out right now because April has to do her hair in the next half hour and then get on the subway to Manhattan, Maya ordered. Are we really going to still do this TV thing? I whined. Yes, Maya and Andy replied simultaneously. But do you not both agree that this is far more interesting? They both did, but then there was the whole matter of the $10,000. Later, after I had been through a quick rinse and was flat ironing my hair, I called to Maya from the bathroom. What were the misspelled words? Written, released, she thought for a second before poking her head into the bathroom, album and August. I-A-M-U, I said. Hmm? She asked as she sat down on the toilet. Not to pee or anything, just because there wasn't anywhere else in the bathroom to sit. Those were the missing letters, I-A-M-U. I-A-M-U, she said. Well, I am fairly certain that I wasn't the one ghost editing Wikipedia from the inside. April, this is a mystery we are not going to solve today. Ugh, I said in frustration. How can you do that? Do what? Don't you want to figure this out? You're going to be on the national news in an hour, hun. Literally dozens of senior citizens are going to see you. You have to look presentable. This is terrible, she laughed. You do know what you're doing right now, right? Huh? April, picture this if you will. A young woman who has created some excellent fan art for her favorite band gets an email to ask if she can make some official merch. And then that woman doesn't just not respond, she actually stops listening to that band entirely. And then remember that you actually did that. I was already growing out of them. I'm embarrassed I ever grooved to those particular tunes. Sure, she said unconvinced. The point is that you hate it when money makes you do things, even when they're interesting things. And I get that. It sucks to have money push you around. And maybe you're a little less used to it than the average person. That's not fair, I replied a bit hurt. Andy is freelancing because his dad can just keep paying his rent while he builds his portfolio. She laughed. Yeah, of course there are people who have more than you. Hell, I have more than you. But you still have way more than most people. But whatever, you're you, and you don't like doing normal stuff. And the normal thing when someone offers you $10,000 to do something is to do it, even if it's stressful and scary. I'm not scared of being on TV, I asserted. Yeah, you are, she countered. I checked, and I found that she was right. How do you know? Because it's scary to go on TV. That's not a you thing, it's a human thing. But you shouldn't do it for the money. And you shouldn't do it because you're scared of it. You should do it because it's going to be strange. You're going to see stuff people don't get to see. You're going to know how things work. And you're going to tell me all about it, and I'm going to be fascinated. And we're going to make fun of the weird news people together, and then we're going to work on this weird Wikipedia shit. Also, in a week, you will have 50,000 new dollars, and that is amazing, and I'm really happy for you. You do the things you have to do in the order you have to do them. Maya has a kind of self-control that almost seems like a foreign language to me. I see her using it, and I know it's real, but it never stops feeling like gibberish to my brain. And we're not going to figure out the Wikipedia shit right now, I finished for her. Nope. I'll be thinking about it, and we'll work on it as soon as you get home. She stood up to take a look at my hair. Did I do okay? I wouldn't call it an adventurous look, but the good news is that no matter what you do up here, she gestured to my hair, all the rest of this, meaning my face and body, is just pure genetically induced hotness. Her eyes were soft, and not for the first time, I had the sensation that she and I had settled into a rhythm of mutual appreciation that was at once wonderfully comfortable and totally terrifying. Chapter 4. That night I discovered that TV interviews are a terrible way to spend time, but an excellent way to make $20,000. I learned pretty quick that I didn't have to do my makeup at home because the vast majority of time spent on television news is spent making television news look impressive. This included painting an entirely new face onto my face as soon as I walked into the building. Interesting that, when I did tag team interviews with Andy, he spent the face reconstruction time eating free donuts on leather couches. To say that I didn't watch TV news is underselling my position. I actively avoided not just the news, but also clips of the news on social media. I believed, or maybe wanted to believe, that I lived in a bubble world, unaffected by the kinds of things that happened on cable news. I was about to get a crash course. Here's the first thing I learned. TV news spends lots of time and money looking impressive because it is not actually impressive. After I saw it from the inside, the shine immediately disappeared. TV news studios are just rooms with people in them. Some of the people are cool and nice. Others are insecure and loud. It's basically just like every other room full of people you've ever been in, except exactly half of it looks extremely fancy and important, and the other half is just concrete and scaffolding. It's like a warehouse crashed into the lobby of a 3-star hotel, and then they just left the mess alone. It occurs to me that this is a fairly good metaphor for what TV news people are like. Half boring and normal, half peculiar caricatures of TV news people. They're so TV news that it seems like they're making fun of TV news people. They have a very particular and standardized way of speaking that is nothing like the way normal people talk. It sounds natural on TV, but in real life it's basically like, whoa, wait, stop, why are you talking like that? We're going to skip around the timeline of the story a bit here, but I have now been on the news a lot, and I have thoughts. At first, I did the news things for the reason Maya identified for me. It was weird and new, and when someone's offering to pay you $10,000 to talk to them for 20 minutes, you do it. I don't like that everyone has a price, but ultimately, you do. And it turns out that mine is below $30,000 an hour. Even before Carl, I spent time thinking about what I'd say if I ever had a platform to say it. That's what art is about, right? I mean, not app interfaces, but art. Much of the best art is about balancing between reflecting culture while simultaneously being removed from it and commenting on it. In the best case, maybe an artist gets to say something about culture that hasn't been said and needs to be said. That's a lofty goal, but not a bad one. I'd spent my 4 years of art school waffling between believing I could do that, or even that I needed to do that, and feeling like I should be more realistic and leave art to real artists. But in those manic moments when I thought I could be some kind of vessel for truth, I'd thought about what I'd say if I someday got a soapbox. That income inequality is out of hand? That all people are pretty damn similar, so it would be great if we stopped hating each other? That prison sentences for nonviolent crimes are dumb? And that drug addiction is a health problem, not a crime problem? Well, I finally got my chance, and I mostly said, No, maybe it's a way of saying, a way to show that we don't see how much we don't see? Just like the news, so many important things happen that, like, nothing seems important. Why do people even watch the news? That's an actual quote from an interview I did on cable news. Direct quote. Great game plan, April. I really knew what I was talking about. Step one, stumble around the point and sound like an idiot.